From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced today that the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will lie in state in the Capitol on Friday, 1 week after her death. Friday or Saturday is also the time when President Trump told Fox News that he expects to announce his choice to fill her vacancy.
And the fight over that replacement is on. Democrats crying hypocrisy as Republicans move forward after refusing to hold a hearing for President Obama's Supreme Court nominee in 2016, more than 8 months before that election. Republicans are saying that was then. They were the opposition. This is now. They support the president. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is here. And Claudia, there are 53 Republicans in the Senate, 47 Democrats. Four Republicans would need to defect to prevent the nomination from going forward. Two have Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski saying they think it should wait until the people have voted. So what other names are floating about possible defectors?
So some potential other names that we are still wondering about include Utah Senator Mitt Romney. That's someone who hasn't expressed any kind of details on where he's going to weigh on this, as well as Cory Gardner of Colorado. That is another Republican senator, and he is in a reelection fight right now, and he hasn't made clear where he's going to fall down on this. And then in terms of other senators, there are some like Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who earlier this year told local state reporters that he wouldn't recommend such a move if Trump wasn't reelected. So far, he's only expressed condolences like some of the others that remain wild cards at this time. And then there's retiring Senator Lamar Alexander, and it's possible he could play a role here as a swing vote.
There's also the possibility that the vote on a nominee could be delayed until the lame duck session between the election and the inauguration, or in this case, as votes are still being counted. But the Democrat Mark Kelly, the former astronaut, husband of Gabby Giffords, is running for Arizona's Senate seat. How does he factor into that vote?
So that's an interesting twist. Because of the individual in that seat at this time, that's Senator Martha McSally. She was appointed to that seat in a special move there. She could have to leave that seat earlier than planned. And that could mean that if Kelly wins this race, he could move into that seat as early as the end of November. And so this is something that the local newspaper there talked to legal experts about this, who said that that was a very big possibility. If that happens, it's going to shrink the margins. Right now, they can lose only three Republicans to proceed with this confirmation vote on the Senate floor. If they lose one of those Republicans in McSally, that means that margin is going to be even that much thinner, and they can't lose the three. They can only lose two at most. They can only lose the three at most because they will have issues, yes, trying to reach those numbers, because it's doubtful any Democrats right now are going to support this move.
The Republican Ted Cruz told Fox News there could be a constitutional crisis if the vacancy isn't filled, especially if the court has to weigh in on the results. Cruz, of course, felt the exact opposite in 2016. But Emily Bazelon, the legal expert, told us that the president and Republicans can constitutionally, pick a justice who could then be the deciding vote if the Supreme Court has to weigh in on the election. But do you see any problems?
So this is going to be completely uncharted territory that we go into if we end up with a situation where there's an election in question and whether we have just an 8-member panel for the Supreme Court. I think that it's going to be tough to say whether there could be issues to come up. It's kind of a day by day as folks are getting a better sense of what could happen with the Supreme Court, if we could have a new justice seated in time or not, and that won't be a factor, or if it will. I think it's a wait and see.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Democrats have been talking about payback, saying that the Republicans are playing with fire, talking about things they might do down the road. But now pretty much they don't have many options. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to look now at the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Erin Carmone is senior correspondent at New York Magazine and co-author of Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Erin, as someone who has spent time with Justice Ginsburg, what stands out to you most?
Well, I knew when I teamed up with Shauna Knizhnik, who came up with the Notorious RBG nickname, that Justice Ginsburg was a giant of the law. But what we actually learned when we researched and reported on her life and had a chance to get to know her personally was how much her own life had shaped her view on the law and how much adversity she'd overcome. And she was determined to transform the world so that other people didn't have to be limited by gender the way that she'd been treated in her life. And so this kind of interplay between the life she lived, where she used to say she had three strikes against her. She was a woman, she was a mother, and she was a Jew. And her legal, both her litigation and her work as a judge, was something that was really important to us to bring out.
You wrote a moving piece over the weekend where you painted the picture of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life growing up and some of those obstacles that she faced. Her family didn't have a lot of money. Her sister died of meningitis when Ginsburg was 2 years old. Her mother died of cancer when she was finishing high school. What do these moments of Ginsburg's life growing up tell us about her career decisions?
Ginsburg was really close to her mother, and her mother was somebody who had shown enormous curiosity and potential, but hadn't been able to get an education because she was a girl. And she actually went and worked in a sweatshop to pay her brother's tuition at Cornell. And so young Ruth, who lost her mother the day before her high school graduation, actually thought very hard about how to live up to the dreams that her mother had for herself and then for her daughter. And she then fought using the tools that she had as a lawyer and then later as a justice to make sure that we, the people, included everybody and didn't narrowly define what it meant to be a woman or what it meant to be a man. She experienced pain not just in her childhood, but, you know, her husband struggled with cancer when they were at Harvard Law School. He then was taken from her in 2010, again, cancer, the same thing that took her from us. And she turned all of that pain into a work ethic that it was not just about her own achievement, but was really about transforming the world for the better.
And you also mention in your piece that her precision only hid her warmth. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a lot of paradoxes at the heart of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was ladylike, but she was revolutionary in her ideas. She was an institutionalist for most of her life. But she became the notorious RBG by challenging the institution of the Supreme Court with her series of really searing dissents. And she was an introvert who was larger than life. She was actually pretty shy. When you would spend time with her, she didn't make a lot of eye contact. She spoke very slowly, very, very thoughtfully. But she showed up. I had the great honor of Justice Ginsburg officiating my wedding. And I think she liked showing up at weddings because they were joyful. You know, I talk about in my piece about how she used to cry at the opera. She had this incredible love affair with her husband. She was devoted to her family. And so as much as she had this kind of fanatical drive, she was also someone who was really emotional.
Mm. That nickname, Notorious RBG, is in reference to the late rapper, the Notorious B.I.G., Christopher Wallace. They were both from Brooklyn. And, you know, we started to see after this that people began wearing Notorious RBG T-shirts. There are bumper stickers. Why do you think Ginsburg has become such a cultural icon for women and young people at such a late age?
You know, when I was a child, there was in my school library a bookshelf that had biographies. And I remember by heart that there were only two of women. And one was Mary Todd Lincoln, and the other one was Julia Ward Howe. And I read them over and over again.
Hmm.
Children's literature has come a long way, but there's still such a hunger to hear the stories of women that were written out of our history. And I think, you know, there's an ongoing debate about whether it matters to have representation at the highest echelons of institutions. And I think she modeled how to do that while staying really true to who she was. She used that perch to talk about who had been left out of the Constitution, to talk about who we the people should have included.
Do you believe that will be her legacy?
Yeah, you know, I asked her when I interviewed her in 2015 how, when the time came, she would want to be remembered. And she said that she wanted to be remembered as somebody who used whatever ability she had to heal tears in the world. And I think we could all agree that the world is pretty broken right now. And she left behind a legacy of doing her best to repair it. At the same time, the tragedy is that if Donald Trump replaces her, that will be part of her legacy too.
her decision to stay on the court, which she made very deliberately, in the end, unfortunately, stands to undo some of the work that she did. But that said, I think, you know, it's much bigger than any one appointment, the body of work that she's left behind. In 10 years, she transformed. This is 10 years she spent as the co-founder of the ACLU Women's Rights Project. She transformed women's status under the Constitution. And that, I hope, will be durable.
Erin Carmon is senior correspondent at New York Magazine and co-author of Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya.
The University of Washington's Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, or IMHE, estimates that American deaths from COVID-19 could total just under 379,000 by the end of the year. That's an increase of 179,000 or more deaths in just 4 months. In the shorter term, the IHME model predicts deaths during October will climb to 1,038 a day and 2,200 a day in November. There are dozens of other models. How does this work? Well, today we're going to take a look at two thought to be among the most reliable. Professor Lauren Ansel Myers is director of the COVID-19 Modeling Consortium at the University of Texas Austin. They track cell phone data. Their prediction is similar to the University of Washington's, that deaths might go up from 1,000 to 2,000 a day in the near future. Professor Myers, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we've also got Nicholas Reich. He's a professor of biostatistics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His is considered one of the best of the most useful tools, the Ensemble model. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
What do you use?
So we have been working with the CDC for the last 4 years to develop an approach that combines predictions from a bunch of different models around the country. Some of them use mobility data, others use data on the age structure of populations. But one of the things that we've seen is that some of the most accurate models tend to be the models that are the simplest. For example, one of the things that these models are trying to predict are how many new deaths over the next week. And some of the best, most accurate models only use counts of daily and weekly deaths.
That's so interesting. I mean, what you're saying is that the accumulated public health official reports on just how many deaths there have been is something that is the most beneficial for you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, really, you don't need necessarily much more than just the public data sources that are out there for just a few weeks into the future.
Professor Myers, we know that you use cell phone data. How do you use that cell phone data?
We use cell phone data, first of all, because you know, human movement and human contact patterns are what fuel pandemics. The cell phone mobility data, it sort of gives us a useful window. We can see how many hours a day people are spending at home. We can see how often they're going out to places like bars and restaurants and parks. We use that data to gauge how much people are out and about in these communities. And what we see, indeed, is that when people increase mobility, we tend to see increases in cases and hospitalizations and deaths in the following weeks and months. And when people decrease their mobility, the pandemic starts to slow down. But the one thing the cell phone data doesn't tell us is what people are actually doing when they're going out in public, whether they're wearing face masks, whether they're keeping their distance. That's the big unknown.
So, Nick, you would take Lauren's mobility research and, as we said, public death records and crunch that with other data.
Yeah, I mean, what's so important about the Ensemble approach is that it takes the strengths of all of these different modeling approaches. And when you combine them together, you end up with something that is sort of greater than the sum of their parts. Some of the other models are using sort of social media activity on different platforms. There's a Facebook survey that our collaborators at Carnegie Mellon have been administering, and that provides a pretty interesting signal about the infection rates at counties and towns and cities mm-hmm. around the country. These are supplements to the standard public health data.
Google can see how many people are Googling, do I have COVID-19 if I lost my sense of taste? And Kinza Thermometers is looking at fever outbreaks in different areas. So there's just all sorts of different ways. But I want to get to what you guys are seeing.
I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what is happening right now. We're seeing big uptick in the movement data in some communities, and a lot of that is being driven by schools and college campuses. Based on the movement data alone, that suggests we could see an uptick in transmission, which might translate to an uptick in hospitalizations and deaths down the road. However, what we can't see in the data is how safely these campus reopenings are going.
Nick, you at the beginning of the month, we're seeing deaths decline a bit, which is great, but still staying at about 5,000 a week. The University of Washington estimate could be double that just several months down the road. But that could happen, right, with schools starting to open and people going indoors.
So one of the things that I think is so important to keep in mind as we try to find a crystal ball, if you were to go and scour the internet today for all the available data about COVID-19, you could get a pretty good sense of what's happening today. But it wouldn't be a perfect sense because people are floating around in the country infected but asymptomatic, and it's really hard even just to get a perfect snapshot of right now. And then you step out one step further and you say, okay, now let's think about 1 week ahead and 3 weeks ahead. What we've seen is that for predicting an outcome like deaths, we can make fairly accurate predictions for the next few weeks. But looking past the next few weeks, a good analogy here is to think about weather forecasts. You know, if I'm trying to plan a trip next weekend, it's maybe worth looking at the forecast to see if it's going to rain 5 or 7 days from now, maybe even 10 days from now. But beyond that, don't bother because those forecasts aren't accurate.
Well, then what do you think, Nick, of the Washington University model, which projects all the way out to the end of the year?
There can really be value in looking at models to help us get a sense of what might happen much further in the future. However, any sort of prediction that you're getting out of a model like that is going to be so heavily dependent on all of the assumptions that are going into that model. What different governmental policies are going to be in place, how human behavior is going to change. So these models can be used to help explore what I call like a what-if scenario. What if everybody started wearing masks today and all the schools opened? Or what if bars closed and schools reopened? And you can imagine all these different scenarios. And these can be really useful planning tools for decision makers.
I will say, you know, when we make forecasts or put forecasts either on the ensemble or our own website, we make a point of being clear that we don't think you can forecast more than 3 or 4 weeks out. And when I think about these projections, they're valuable. But I don't think of them as forecasts. I think of them as plausible future scenarios. We, you know, as society and communities have control over the fate of the pandemic. What's going to happen beyond 3 weeks really depends on the decisions that we are making today as individuals and as communities. The IHME's projections through the end of the year, their projection suggests that if we're cautious in the months ahead, we may not even exceed 300,000 deaths. But, you know, if we go in the other direction, deaths could be over 800,000. And it's not like forecasting the weather where the atmosphere is going to determine what's going to happen. And we are going to determine what's going to happen. Mm-hmm.
I like that. It's not like the weather in that we can do something about it, which you can't with the weather. But Nick, it is like the weather in that you can't look too far out. Let's take a second to say we're speaking with Professor Nick Reich, University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Lauren Ansel Myers, professor at the University of Texas Austin, about ensemble modeling the arc of the COVID-19 pandemic. That means combining studies. Is there a moment when you were looking at the data coming in and it hit you? Wow. And Nick, maybe I'll start with you.
The spring was such a blur, and some of the early indications of the seriousness was when early on we were conducted a survey of some modeling experts. Some of the estimates were incredibly pessimistic. Like, I think the upper range of number of deaths possible in the U.S. was 1 million for 2020. And I think it was maybe at that moment when it really started to sink in.
And Lauren, how about you?
It was, I want to say, very beginning of February, and we were analyzing some data that we had obtained by scraping websites from public health departments in 18 different provinces in China. And we realized that there were cases where a person had been infected by somebody with no symptoms. This was one of the first pieces of evidence of this pre-symptomatic transmission, of the silent transmission. And when we saw that, it was alarming. It was the first indication that this thing was going to spread swiftly and it was going to spread silently. And in fact, when we shared our initial analyses with our colleagues at the CDC, their answer was, oh no, you must have made a mistake. It became obvious that we were not going to be able to control the spread of this virus using measures that we had been able to use successfully to contain SARS.
Well, I want to ask you both as we close, is it safe to say that Lauren, right now, with your model using cell phone data at the University of Texas at Austin, you see deaths maybe rising from 1,000 a day to almost 2,000. And Nick, you see them maybe declining a little bit, still staying at about 5,000 a week?
I actually really want to emphasize that we are at an unusually uncertain time, given the recent opening of schools and colleges. And so with all of our models, we could be anywhere from, you know, slightly elevated deaths per day from where we are today to really, you know, quite a bit higher death rate. The important message is the decisions we make today are going to impact the number of deaths that we see a month from now.
And I think that's one of the reasons taking these longer term forecasts with a grain of salt is so critical.
That's Nicholas Reich, professor of biostatistics at UMass Amherst. We also spoke with Lauren Ansel Myers, professor of integrative biology and statistics at the University of Texas, Austin. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
Yeah, thanks again.
Tropical Storm Beta is just what you guys on the Gulf Coast didn't need. It's not a hurricane, and it's not expected to become one, but forecasters say it's going to bring drenching rain and storm surges to a region that's still recovering from hurricanes Laura and Sally. Those storms made landfall in Louisiana and Alabama. Flash flooding will be possible this week in Arkansas and Mississippi as the storm system moves further inland. But right now, Beta's more of a threat to the Texas coast, so let's go to Texas and bring in Galveston County, Texas Judge Mark Henry. Judge Henry, Mark, you're the top elected official in the county responsible for emergency response and preparedness. So are you prepared and are you seeing the effects of Beta?
Hi, Robin. Yes, we are definitely seeing the effects. Fortunately, we're no strangers to hurricanes, so our preparedness for this storm started about 4 days ago. I'm looking at a radar right now. We are going to see some rain here and tropical storm force winds probably for the next 24 to 36 hours.
Yeah. How do you prepare for that?
A number of things. First of all, we issued a voluntary evacuation for Bolivar Peninsula, which is a part of the county that's kind of cut off from the rest of us. There's a ferry service operated by the state. That ferry service was suspended yesterday morning, and there's now water coming over the road, which is Highway 87 in Bolivar. So we issued a voluntary evacuation, letting people know that conditions are going to be difficult to get around over there. I think a lot of people took us up on that and left. Those who are there now are kind of stuck. We can't get to them. If they can't drive through the waters and we ask them not to, then they're going to have to stay in place there for 24, 36 hours. We also position high water rescue vehicles and road and bridge crews all around the county. So regardless of where an activity might occur, we can get someone there within probably 15 minutes at the latest.
Yeah. Well, as Glenn Campbell sang, Galveston, oh Galveston, I mean, you have experienced, you know, the deadliest hurricane in American history, the storm in 1900 that killed,
correct,
you know, maybe 6,000 people. Your city hit hard by Hurricane Ike in 2008. That storm, yes, did $30 billion in damage. So in one way, you might be used to this, but we also know that hurricanes are increasing in force because of the warm waters, global warming. You know, they're picking up more rain and dumping more rain. You know, you can't get too used to this, right? I mean, are people nervous?
We absolutely don't get used to it, and that's what concerns us the most, is people saying, oh, you know, now I went through Tropical Storm Beta, it wasn't that big a deal, so the next time they issue an evacuation order, I don't have to listen to it because I know exactly what to expect. Each storm is different. Each storm is a surge event, a rain event, or a wind event, or a combination of those. Looks like Beta is going to kind of become a surge event only. We were expecting 15 inches of rain just 24 hours ago. They've now downgraded that to 6 to 7 inches, which honestly, we could use that much rain. We don't need 15. But our concern is people not taking them seriously and thinking that now they've been through a minor one that they can just stay for the next one.
Well, Mark Henry, we wish you and everybody in the area there all the best in getting through this.
Thank you so much.
That's Mark Henry. He's the Galveston County judge, the official in that county responsible for emergency response and preparedness. Again, Mark, thank you so much, and take care.
Thanks, Robin.
And you may be wondering why this storm is called Beta. Well, it's because forecasters ran out of the traditional storm names on Friday, forcing them to use the Greek alphabet for just the second time since the 1950s.
Climate change isn't just transforming our environment and weather. It's also impacting our bodies and our health, which is why a group of doctors created a new teaching framework for medical residents on how to address climate change as a health issue. Joining us now is Dr. Rebecca Phillips-Born, a pediatrician at Emory University School of Medicine and lead author of this new framework. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. Well, doctor, what inspired you and your colleague to publish this list of guidelines for folks to understand the effects of climate change on our health?
Well, we wanted to make sure that our residents and future doctors will be prepared for those challenges that they are going to face in their practice. So that even though now the American Medical Association and other organizations have called for health professionals to engage in the space to teach trainees about the impacts of climate change on health, until now, there wasn't really a framework to support educators who are heeding those calls to action.
You know, I think so many of us understand that we are impacted by our environment, but how do you break it down in your framework so that it's tangible? What are some issues or practices you include, and what can doctors really do to be prepared?
That's a great question. And this work really was a collaboration between, on one hand, folks who are experts in climate and health, and on the other hand, folks who are experts in resident education, so that we not only at what is of the most importance to health, but also what's going to be feasible within the framework of what medical residents are supposed to learn already. So we broke it down in terms of what are the harms to health from climate change? How does climate change require adaptations in our clinical practice? And how does climate change disrupt healthcare delivery?
What are some examples of how climate change is already impacting our health? Now in California, for example, we're experiencing lung problems because of the smoke. But what else are you seeing?
There are health harms from climate change that really span nearly every organ system and every aspect of health delivery. So just some of the other examples, climate change is worsening chronic conditions like respiratory illness, and not just from wildfires, but also from air pollution and heat, those effects on asthma incidence and severity. And then we're seeing emerging threats like a new kind of kidney disease called heat-related nephropathy from the effects of extreme heat itself on the kidneys.
Doctor, how does this play out in your clinical work with you and your colleagues?
We see these risks and challenges that our patients are facing here in clinic. And there are, again, so many examples, and it depends on where you practice. So my colleagues in the emergency room tell me about the increased incidence of asthma they see on extremely hot days in Atlanta and in children in the summer. There are times in primary care clinics, some examples that stand out to me are during Hurricane Irma, when there were almost 7 million people under evacuation orders from Florida. We cared for mothers and their newborn babies who are displaced from their homes, their support system, in this very vulnerable stage of that baby's life.
How do you even begin to treat these types of conditions when they're exacerbated by our environments?
That's a great question. When I work with med students, I tell them that patients spend more than 99% of their time outside of the exam room. So then how do we as doctors, we can't just deliver treatment in this safe clinical space and ignore the risks that patients face in the rest of their life. So part of it is about recognizing those risks and those what we call in medicine the environmental determinants of health, What we hope is through this framework, we can teach residents to recognize the health impacts of climate change in order to both treat and manage them and also prepare our patients to avoid these risks where possible.
How do you expect the medical profession might have to change in order to address the climate change problem? You, of course, have developed this framework, and that's a start. But what do you think needs to be done so that medical staff are prepared for the continual changes in our climate?
Yes, building off the last question, I think part of it is really at its core, recognizing that the health of people and the environment that we live in are, of course, intertwined and related. And as physicians, we take an oath in medicine, the Hippocratic Oath, kind of summarized as first do no harm. And yet our healthcare facilities are part of the problem in terms of the carbon emissions that we create that actually does harm to the patients that we hope to serve. So the healthcare industry is faced with this transition to producing less carbon, less greenhouse gas emissions in the care we provide. And I think physicians have an important voice in that discussion as well.
That's Dr. Rebecca Phillips-Bourne, a pediatrician at Emory University School of Medicine and lead author of a new framework that addresses climate change as a health issue. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's get up to speed now on the Trump administration's ongoing battle over Chinese-owned technology companies TikTok and WeChat. The Commerce Department says it will fight a ruling by a judge in San Francisco that blocked a ban on WeChat yesterday, just hours before it was set to take effect. TikTok also averted a ban in the U.S. that was set to begin last night after its owner, ByteDance, announced a new partnership with Oracle and Walmart. Let's bring in Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode and host of Recode Media. And Peter, explain how this TikTok deal announced over the weekend is supposed to work exactly. Oracle and Walmart are not buying the app outright as President Trump had initially said he wanted, right?
No. And the caveat here is there's even though there isn't an announced deal, there is still a lot of back and forth and uncertainty about how any of this is supposed to work. But the very broad strokes are Oracle and Walmart will take minority stakes in a company that will eventually be called TikTok Global, which will supposedly be based in the United States. The original owner of TikTok, ByteDance, will still have some sort of stake in the company. And they're more or less sort of moving that company over to the U.S. And then some U.S. companies will have a partial ownership stake in it.
Partial ownership, but President Trump told Fox and Friends this morning that TikTok will be totally controlled by Oracle. Let's listen.
And if we find that they don't have total control, then we're not going to approve the deal.
Okay.
If they do have, it would be nice to keep the technology. It would also be nice because it's good competitively with others. You know, having the competition for Facebook and others would be good. But we will be watching it very closely.
Trump also said TikTok will bring about 25,000 jobs to Texas. And he said Saturday the company would make, quote, $5 billion in contribution towards education. But ByteDance said there's no such plans. I mean, you just kind of laid that out. What more do we know about this, where this is all coming from?
You know, sometimes Donald Trump says things that turn out to not be true. It's pretty consistent. The motivations for this deal remain sort of unclear. There's a lot of talk about the idea that Oracle will control the user data that TikTok's users generate. But there is a big question about who will control the algorithm and the underlying software that powers TikTok. Unclear whether China will sign off on this. The suggestion is that they wouldn't have gone ahead with this deal if China hadn't sort of given it its tacit or explicit approval. Mm-hmm. But again, this is a very powerful country that is essentially seeing one of their premier assets being sort of forced to sell part or all of itself to an American company. So I wouldn't count that as a done deal either.
Where does this leave WeChat? The Commerce Department said today that it's going to challenge a decision by a federal judge yesterday that blocked new downloads that was supposed to take effect at midnight. I mean, is there any deal pending for WeChat and what's next for them?
Yeah, so WeChat is a very app that's hugely popular with Chinese Americans and hugely popular in China. It's how you communicate. It's how you buy things. It's your game network. It's your social network. And it does not appear to have any deal in the place like Oracle and Walmart have for TikTok. So as of now, the U.S. government is trying to shut it down, not just to shut down new downloads of the app, but to sort of cripple the thing entirely, so it's basically useless within the U.S. So right now a judge has said this can't go forward. The Commerce Department will challenge that, and we'll see. Again, you don't see it generating a ton of attention in the press or from politicians, but if you're Chinese American, this is a very big deal.
That's Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode and host of Recode Media. Peter, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Two universities in Illinois, less than an hour drive away from each other, took different approaches to reopening for the fall semester. One has been testing and retesting students and staff for COVID-19. On the other campus, testing is limited. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom starts our story on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Marissa Hardwick just got tested for COVID-19 inside a big white tent. She says collecting enough spit to take the saliva test can be a challenge, especially when you can't drink or eat anything for at least an hour before.
I like sour candy, so that's why I always think about, like, sour stuff. It makes my mouth salivate, so...
Hardwick is a senior majoring in kinesiology. She's impressed by the university's massive testing program. Faculty, staff, and students have to get tested at least once a week in order to enter campus buildings, twice a week for undergrads. So far, the U of I has conducted hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 tests with a positivity rate of less than 1%. But Hardwick is not surprised there are currently around 2,000 cases of COVID-19 on this campus of roughly 35,000 students living in the area and more than 13,000 faculty and staff members.
The type of school this is and the community that it is, it's not a quiet school. You know, it's known for being like a party location.
That may be why there are already more than twice as many COVID-19 cases on campus than what university researchers predicted for the entire semester. University officials blame the rise in cases on student behavior. Others, like anthropology professor Catherine Clancy, blame the university. She says the school didn't account for student behavior when they created their reopening plan.
We made them think they were going to come here and have maybe not a normal campus experience, but still a desirable campus experience, when what we really need them to do is so much more challenging and mentally taxing and distressing than what they could actually do.
Administrators placed students on temporary lockdown earlier this month, and so far it seems to be working. Daily case numbers have declined, but the total number of cases remains high compared to other universities and colleges nationwide. So far, though, university officials remain confident in their testing program. U of I epidemiologist Rebecca Lee Smith says the campus's testing program is the envy of other universities, who she says are testing mostly symptomatic people.
The majority of our cases are asymptomatic. So the number of cases we have is the iceberg. They have the tip.
About an hour drive away, there's another public university which has taken a different approach to testing on its campus. Dana Vollmer from member station WGLT in Normal picks up the story.
Oh! Yes!
Since it reopened, Illinois State University has had about 1,400 positive COVID-19 test results on its campus of about 18,000 students living in the Bloomington-Normal area. Unlike the U of I, COVID-19 testing at ISU was optional until just last week when the school announced it will require students to get tested soon, but it's unclear when or how that will happen. Eduardo Monk is a freshman, one of the nearly 3,800 living in a dorm. He says he's careful about mask wearing. Still, he doesn't think college students have much to worry about if they do get the coronavirus.
And really, I'm not going to limit myself a whole lot. Again, I can't put my whole entire life on pause. There's a million more things I could die from just stepping outside my door.
ISU President Larry Dietz says most students are following the rules, and he says the university's COVID-19 numbers don't tell the whole story.
The truth is, many state universities don't test nearly as much as Illinois State does, and they don't transparently report positive cases as does ISU. Other universities test so often that their positivity rates skew lower through simple division.
So far, Illinois State University has conducted about 8,000 COVID-19 tests.
The University of Illinois, more than 300,000. Sarah Kobe is an epidemiologist at the University of Chicago. She calls ISU's optional testing program problematic.
To be fair, it is also the mode for basically every state and other large institution I know, which is, you know, allow testing, report those test results, but not report those test results or even, you know, really enable testing in the way that allows us to understand trends in transmission, you know, really well. It's unquestionably risky.
Kobe says schools need to test students and staff every few days to catch the virus before it can spread. Without that kind of systematic surveillance testing, she says you can't really tell how many people are infected. And while Kobe calls the testing program created by the University of Illinois impressive, she says the school could have done a better job accounting for student behavior and how that might affect the spread of the virus.
And so I think a lot of boxes had to be checked, you know, to do this safely. And I don't think any university has really checked all of them.
For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
And I'm Dina Vollmer.
And we want to thank also WGLT's Katrina Peterson for her help on this story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.